You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Coming up on the free-for-all, Pulitzer Prize-winning opinion columnist Bret Stephens, who doesn't mince any words, comes in to talk to us about the Republican election, specifically the Donald. Also, the fixing scandal in tennis. Is it a big deal? What is the sport doing? What also needs to be done? Plus, Jim Cherusmi, tennis fan and unrepentant gambler, gives us his thoughts about whether or not tennis is a good bet. Coming up, free-for-all.
You're listening to Free For All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
This is Jason Gay, and this is the Free For All. It is Thursday, January 21, and we do have an AFC and an NFC championship coming up. But you know, Jim Cherusmi.
What's going on, Jason?
I always thought when you and I launched this podcast that we were going to be diversified. We were not going to just stick to sports, even though people will sometimes send you emails. Stick to sports. We were going to look out across the paper, and we were going to bring on interesting people with great stories to tell and talk about stuff that you don't expect to necessarily find in a sports podcast. And we're going to the cleanup hitters right now today, Jim.
Yeah, that's why I left my betting sheet aside.
Yeah,
I thought it was
we're not going to some sort of, you know, small part of the paper. We're going right to the cleanup hitters, the editorial page. And with us today, Bret Stephens. He's the deputy editorial page editor. You are also the author of the Global View column for which he was awarded in 2013 the People's Choice Awards. No, you were awarded the Pulitzer Prize. And Bret, tell me, do they still give you a pickup truck for winning the Pulitzer Prize, or has it changed?
It's changed a little bit. It's actually a subcompact.
It's a subcompact. And does it say Pulitzer Prize, like sort of a sticker alongside the front window?
There's a kind of, there are two upside down P's. it's an insider's thing.
Well, we're honored to have you here. You're the first Pulitzer winner, I believe. I haven't checked everybody's Pulitzer resume here on the Free For All. And I want to talk about, you know, you write the Global View column. You also are somewhat of an expert in the GOP and the state of the GOP. And, you know, Bret, we have an election on.
Yeah, which is becoming like an extreme sport, right?
Yes. No. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because the ratings for the Republican debates are NFL-like.
Yeah.
They are record-breaking. Everyone that gets one, I mean, they're the most, outside of a football game, what you probably want more if you're a television programmer than a Republican debate right now.
But I found fascinating that the last Democratic debate was on network television, NBC, and all the Republican debates were on cable.
Well, they switch them around, and then the GOP actually just yanked one out of the midst of CNBC.
Right.
And moved it over to CNN.
I think so.
Because they were not too happy with the CNBC performance. But this spectacle, this thing that is riveting America, I've read what you've written. I can't imagine that you are sharing in the riveting. You might be astonished, appalled. I'm curious to get your take on what you're seeing right now.
I don't know. I think it's like the transition in America from, you know, old-fashioned boxing matches, you know, Thrilla in Manila or whatever, to, you know, extreme fighting
UFC
events.
UFC, steel cage, like no holds bar.
No, that's exactly, in a way, it parallels that transition.
Yeah.
More violent, more brutish, more less rules-based.
Yeah. And yet intensely popular.
And intensely popular in a way that makes you kind of tremble for the future, not only of America, but of what used to be called Western civilization.
Now, one of the things that
I get into trouble for saying this, but, you know, I'm one of those obnoxious, I feel like a little bit like one of those obnoxious tenured professors who suddenly yes. discovers that they can say pretty much exactly what's on their mind.
It's a beautiful thing.
It's wonderful. I get all this mail from Trump supporters.
Yes,
What an evil rhino establishmentarian I am, and I just kind of shrug.
Now, one of the great things to do with columnists of any kind, Jim, is to bring them onto the show and read them things that they wrote years ago.
Oh, God. I didn't expect this.
But this was November 2012, and Barack Obama had just won a second term, and Bret Stephens wrote in the Wall Street Journal a couple of paragraphs I'd like to call to your attention. He said, one, can we as a GOP base demand an IQ exam as well as a test of basic knowledge from congressional and presidential candidates? This is not a flippant suggestion. There are at least five Senate seats in this election cycle that might have been occupied by a Republican come January had not for the invincible stupidity of the candidate stood in the way. Another suggestion, running for president should be undertaken only by those with a reasonable chance of winning a general election. It should not be seen as an opportunity to redeem a political reputation or to audition for a gig on Fox News. Brett, nobody listened to you.
Yeah, apparently. That was one of the Pulitzer-winning columns. So I got a subcompact,
but
I didn't exactly change the political conversation.
You can't take it away.
But I still hold to that view all the more so because right now the two Republican front runners, a certain junior senator from Texas and a certain hairpiece from Manhattan, are unelectable. I've been screaming, as it were, or writing at the. Can you write at the top of your lungs?
Sure.
To my usually conservative readers, that this is a fact. That if Trump or Cruz are the nominee, they will lose.
Yes,
they will lose to Bernie Sanders.
Yes,
they will lose to Hillary Clinton.
You believe either Cruz or Trump would lose to Bernie Sanders?
Yeah, I think they might actually. Well, let's put it this way. I think they'd have a heck of a race against Bernie Sanders, which tells you something about how weak they are.
Right.
And I don't expect Bernie to be the Democratic nominee in the end, despite all the surprises of this season. I may find myself having the opportunity to simply rerun that column this November, like be able to skip a column week, not have to stress out, just say, this was what I wrote 4 years ago. Read again.
I love it. You are not a Trump detractor come lately to this. You were out rather early in the early days when people thought that Donald Trump would say something that, you know, wasn't politically acceptable and would be quickly drummed from the race. You were out very quickly with a column. It was in August. And how's this for first sentences, Jim? If you don't find Donald Trump appalling, you're appalling. You have my attention, Mr. Stephens.
I think there were a few canceled journal subscriptions as a result of that.
There's another beautiful line in here, and he goes on to describe what the so-called appeal of Donald Trump is, and then they come to this paragraph, Jim. This is a dandy. And so forth and so on, a parade of semi-sophisticated theories that act as bathroom deodorizers to mask the stench of this candidacy. Mr. Trump is a loudmouth vulgarian appealing to quieter vulgarians.
Can I just interject here? That so I received a ton of mail for that column.
Yes. Positive.
Not all of it positive. But a lot of people wrote to tell me, they say, I'm not some vulgarian. First of all, I probably make a lot more money than you do. And then they trotted out the credentials, precisely the kind of
vulgar thing.
Maybe they would send me pictures of the faucets in their bathroom to demonstrate their non-vulgarian qualities. But I hold to that column. I'm proud I wrote that column. I'll always be proud.
Has anything over the past 3 months disabused you of any of these opinions?
No, not at all. And on the contrary, I mean, he's only gone on to say things even more appalling than the comments about, say, Megyn Kelly or John McCain. Quite frankly, I think his cheering of Vladimir Putin, who just now has been found by a British inquest to have likely ordered the nuclear poisoning of a Mr. Litvinenko in London 10 or so years ago. All of that just kind of confirms the original point. And I think it's important for columnists to have the independence to say this. I have nothing but contempt, Jason, for all of those kind of cautious souls who are busy saying, well, we don't like Trump, but, you know, he's you have to understand the phenomenon and the rage of the people.
Right.
No, you don't. You have to stand up to the phenomenon. I mean, when you're a columnist, you're handed a sword by your employer. Go use that sword.
Right.
And what's the worst that can happen to you? They'll take away your column, but it hasn't happened. I don't think it will happen.
You're not in love with the alternative here, though. If you believe it is a two-person race between Donald Trump and Senator Cruz, you're not terribly impressed by
Cruz. No, I mean, look, it matters that it tells you something that every Republican senator, I mean, you know, maybe I don't like some of the Republican senators, maybe I do. Every single Republican senator hates Ted Cruz, right? Now, you know, I hate to go all sort of Lord of the Flies and say kill Piggy, but that tells you something about the character of the guy. I thought for me, and as a New Yorker, when he went on about New York values, it was one of those moments where you really needed. I think we should have air sickness bags for watching these debates. This is a guy whose wife is a senior executive at Goldman Sachs.
Right.
Now, I love Goldman. Right. May they prosper. Right.
It's like playing center field for the Yankees.
What is he talking about? And what kind of rubes does he think he's talking to?
Right.
I mean, the basically.
Well, you touched on this when you wrote about a speech that he gave to the Heritage Foundation not that long ago about sort of the, you know, the dumbing down of the Cruz rhetoric and the, sort of the intellectual dishonesty of that. And that just seems to be part and parcel of what you're talking about.
Look, you know, Ted Cruz, by all accounts, was a brilliant student at Harvard. So he, unlike Donald Trump, doesn't have the excuse of he can't plead ignorance.
Yeah.
He knows exactly what he's doing. This is a guy with a, you know, high-powered brain. He clerked for the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Right.
And this is what he does. And he reminds me of people one meets in life who know they're clever. And because they know they're clever, they think they can get away with anything. They think they can talk their way out of any lie, half-truth, you name it, because they think you're stupid.
Right.
And that upsets me. And so there's a character issue. I mean, even if I agreed, and I probably do agree with Ted Cruz on a lot of stuff policy-wise, but that character issue, I think Ted Cruz is what liberals thought Richard Nixon was.
Right.
Although Nixon was actually somewhat better than that caricature, somewhat, right? Cruz is that caricature.
Yeah. Do you have the capacity at all at the Stevens home to watch a debate? Can you even watch it? Can you bear
it? Well, no. I mean, typically what I'll do is my wife is a sensible human being, and out of respect for her, you know, we have one television in our home.
Right.
So what I'll do is I'll then watch it on streaming video late at night when they've gone to bed.
And can you actually, like, you know, is it like Clockwork Orange? Can you actually make yourself watch it and process it on any sort of intellectual level? Or are you
I do. I have to. It's my job.
It's like me watching a Jets game. I got to do it even if I don't want to. I have to watch the Jets.
Yeah, I mean, it's at that level of pain. I have to watch this stuff. I have to be aware of what it is that I am going on about in my columns.
Now, if either one of these gentlemen become the nominee and, as you expect, goes down in flames to either Clinton or Sanders, what's next for the GOP? And it's sort of a two-pronged question. You know, we keep hearing about this, you know, the call, you know, your colleague over at the pamphlet in Times Square, the New York Times, David Brooks, wrote about how, you know, basically a call to arms for the Republican establishment. But what is the Republican establishment at this point? You know, we sort of have this impression of what it is, but does it actually exist as a force anymore?
Yeah, it always sort of amuses me when I'm doing the dishes to think someone out there thinks I'm the Republican establishment,
sure.
You know, or when I'm cleaning up after my
there he goes.
Disheveled children. This here goes the Republican establishment. Listen, good question. And I think this is fundamental. I think we're seeing something like we may be seeing. I hope it won't happen, but we may be seeing something like the ideological crack up, not only of the Republican Party, but of what used to be called the conservative movement, which right. used to be able to get itself around some reasonably good ideas in favor of free trade, in favor of a strong defense, an engaged foreign policy. And now increasingly, and you see this with the talk about immigration and the obsession with immigration, it's increasingly becoming a party about identity, racial identity or ethnic identity. But that's the conservatism of Marine Le Pen in France, for instance, or Viktor Orban in Hungary. And frankly, it's a small conservatism. It's an ugly conservatism. I think the best, the better angels of our nature, if I may quote the original Republican, tell us we should be a movement about aspiration, yeah. about opportunity, about saying to people, it isn't where you're from, it's where you're going. And America has always been not the land of ontology, to use terms from, you know, philosophy,
sure.
but teleology, from of destination, not origin. And so I'm attracted to those candidates who talk about the aspirational side of the conservative message, about what you could become, how much better you could be doing if you weren't being taxed as much, regulated as much, coddled as much, you name it. And that's where the future of the movement, if it has one, lies. It's not going to lie in a dwindling white majority, eventually becoming a minority, trying to assert its rights by declaiming furiously against Americans who think a little differently than they do. And it's definitely not going to become one if every time a Republican or a conservative has an opinion that differs slightly from yours, he is liable to be excommunicated.
Right.
I mean,
do you feel that below that rage and boil that there is, are you confident that below that rage and boil that there is an electorate that wants that? That is a substantial enough constituency to nominate conservatives. I mean, not nominate conservatives, to elect conservatives to
Well, 2 months ago, I thought that.
Yeah.
A month ago, I started to have doubts. And now I'm now on the eve of Iowa. We're really, you know, yeah. really scratching my head here because I keep waiting for the moment of sobriety to arrive.
Yeah.
I keep thinking, okay, there'll be a huge New Year's hangover and all the Trump supporters will wake
right.
up and they'll be like, oh, man.
No, if anything, you're seeing things like Bob Dole saying, you know, well, maybe, you know, Trump's the guy. He's a deal maker.
Well, Bob Dole is a bad messenger, right? You don't want a guy who was destroyed as thoroughly as he was
right.
in 96 as your messenger.
Right.
But you do need serious people who say, look, this is our system of government. All these people, by the way, all these people going on about the rhinos, Republicans in name only.
Right.
Donald Trump is the ultimate
yeah.
rhino.
Sure.
So what are they talking about? So look, I mean, it's going to be it's going to be a season in which politics is going to be way more fast moving and unpredictable than sport, and so maybe we'll get the edge on you.
Yeah,
going
maybe
forward.
That's what I wanted to ask Brett. It was like, you know, 2 months ago, Cruz wasn't even looked at as one of the front runners, and suddenly, you know, he's one of the top two. So how indicative are these polls? And once, you know, on the eve of Iowa, once people start to vote, do you think that will swing?
Look, you know, I have lost faith in my own political instincts to some extent, if I'm being fully candid, because I thought surely Trump would have exploded months ago. Surely people would see the kind
yeah.
of phoniness of Cruz. They haven't. So I mean, you know, as the great physicist Niels Bohr once said, prediction is very difficult, especially about the future.
I get the feeling, you know, there's always been this, you know, conservative hope about Rubio and that there would be a Rubio rise, and it hasn't manifested. In fact, he spends a lot of time duking it out with Cruz, which I feel is probably a mistake for him. But I also get the feeling in the last couple of weeks there's a little bit of Kasich like out there, like people trying to like, you know, get that going. It's not catching on nationally, but is there any momentum there?
Well, look, there is clearly momentum for that. There are the Trumpkins, right?
Sure.
There's the Cruz control crowd. And then there are candidates, whether it's Bush, Rubio, Kasich, or Christie, who all essentially are the same person, right?
Yeah.
They're all reasonable conservatives with governing or political records who know something about policymaking. And at some point, they are all going to coalesce around one person.
Yeah.
Now, if you add Kasich, depending on the polls you're looking at, Kasich, Bush, Rubio, and Christie, you have probably 35% of the vote,
yeah,
give or take. And, you know, my hope is that one of these guys is going to emerge and be a serious contender. But we'll have to see. And, you know, we have to I'm having to already come to terms with this idea that come July is the Republican convention.
Yeah.
There's going to be a Republican candidate who not only is unelectable, not only isn't going to win, but whom I would have immense difficulty in my heart supporting, never, and also in not to mention in public. And look, if you lose, if the candidate loses a guy like me, they're going to lose.
When Trump was in here earlier this year, or last year rather, for an editorial board meeting, did they let you in the room?
Oh yes, he was the guy.
Did you snuggle?
I was the guy. His people sought out for a meeting. Weirdly enough.
What were your impressions from that?
Well, it was funny. He made an effort to be gracious with me.
Yeah.
When I was introduced, he said something like, "Oh, Stevens, he's a killer."
Right.
But in a nice way, actually. He really was making an effort to put his best foot forward.
Right.
And I'm told that on a one-to-one level, he can be very gracious and perfectly decent.
I've interviewed him, not on this, but on his goofy TV show career.
Well, look, I mean, Trump is a guy, when he was talking about pouring concrete, all right, this guy clearly knew what he was talking about, you know, and I would love to spend all day with him talking about real estate and whatever reality TV stuff he knows about. It's when he turns to, you know, the kind of policy questions that a president should care about.
Rudimentary.
Well, for instance, he was going on about how the Japanese were killing us economically. And you felt like, hang on, is this the 1980s? Like, Japan is in its, what, seventh recession in 10, something like that.
Yeah.
So how is it that we're getting killed by the Japanese? The kind of mercantilism that defined Japanese economics for so long is precisely what Trump is advocating for the U.S., and it's precisely what's destroyed the Japanese economy. So you're sort of talking to him and like, yeah, but Japan is in recession. Why are we holding them up as this model for a successful economy? Yeah. And the other thing that Trump had is he had a habit of speaking forever, which I share, but I'm not running for president.
Right. But isn't that also, that's kind of a rhetorical strategy, right? It's sort of the question killer is that you, if you can just filibuster, you can kind of prevent a dialogue.
When I was 12 years old, I applied for boarding schools in New England. I grew up in Mexico, and I decided I wanted to go to high school in the States. And so I applied to a bunch of boarding schools. And I remember I was applying to Andover, Phillips Andover. And mind you, I was 12 years old. I was prepubescent. I was barely 12 years old. And the interviewer said, "Brett, what are the prospects for the Mexican middle class in the upcoming election?" I'll never forget it, except that what happened was he asked me this question. I had no idea what the answer was. And so I said, well, in order to answer that, we have to go back to Hernan Cortes' conquest of Mexico in 1519. Right. Then I promptly started reciting what little I knew about Mexican history and then forgot the question.
Yeah.
So I realized I was just in this process of desperately trying to remind myself by continually speaking of what the question was until the interviewer finally cut me off and I didn't get into Andover, their loss. But listening to Trump was a little bit like that, because you'd ask him a question and his mind would just kind of hop to the next little lily pad,
yeah,
you know, like a frog on a pond. And you could see that at some point he'd sort of forgotten the point of departure, but it didn't matter to him. He just kept rolling along.
I have to, you know, I have enjoyed the debates thoroughly. And what I have enjoyed about Trump the most is that, I mean, I don't have the kind of sadness that you might have about it, but he strikes me as like, it reminds me of someone in a book club who has not read the book, but still comes to club.
And wants to talk.
And wants to talk.
That's so true. That's that's exactly it. And you're just like, oh, we have to listen to this guy.
Right. I want to just lastly ask you this because, you know, you always have one eye towards the rest of the world. And, you know, when it comes to issues of, you know, national security, of course, but just general diplomacy, is any one of these front runners, you know, have any appeal to you on that front? And how is the rest of the world looking at this from the outside?
Well, I think any sensible outsider is looking at this. Anyone who's serious and understands that America has to be a sober and serious power must be looking at the current state of the election and thinking, oh my God, this is the ultimate black swan. Right. What if the America, I mean,
right. It's
years,
not like Berlusconi, for example.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Bunga bunga. Right. I mean, if Italy has a bunga bunga prime minister, okay.
Right.
You know, this is Italy, right? If Russia has an evil thug as its president, well, it always has had evil thugs as its president.
Yeah.
But what happens when the United States decides to go rogue? I mean that in a kind of sort of engage a silly season. When you think about it, it's a pretty terrifying thought because we're now living in a world of unprecedented turmoil. I wrote a book about this. We're living in a world where I think the chances of serious war have not been greater than for the last quarter of a century. And you need a United States as the only real superpower to be led by serious people who can command some level of trust and respect from certainly from our allies, if not our enemies. That's not evident right now. I don't see it, by the way. I've been going on about Trump. I certainly don't see it on the Democratic side either.
Sure.
So that's a worrying thought. And, you know, of course, this is a cliche, but Twain's old line, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme. Right now, history is rhyming with the 1930s.
Yeah.
And that worries me because you know that the 1930s led to the next decade.
Sure. Sure. Brett Stevens, thank you so much.
Well, it's an honor being on your show, kidding that I know nothing about sports.
Well, you know, you're not the first person on this podcast to know nothing about sports. And we'll have to have you back before November of 2016, yes. As always, you're listening to the Free For All. We'll be right back with Tennis Fixing.
Hi, this is Veronica Dagger. Catch me midweek every week on Watching Your Wealth, where you learn all you need to know about building your wealth and protecting your money. Check us out at WSJ.com/podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at WSJ Podcasts and become a subscriber on iTunes.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, here's Jason Gay.
We're back. Brett Stevens, he was something, Jim, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Brett offered timely insights right there.
He did give timely insights. I believe we might get our first hate mail here at the Free For All because Brett was none too impressed with our Republican frontrunner at the moment. But a very, very, very informed writer. And we have another one here in the Free For All studio today, Matthew Futterman, global sports writer extraordinaire for the Journal, here to talk about the fixing scandal in tennis.
Yes.
Tennis. BuzzFeed and BBC dropping a story earlier this week, and a lot of us have been reacting to it. Matt, you had a brilliant follow yesterday. But for the folks out there who aren't maybe the biggest tennis fans out there or the biggest gamblers, explain what exactly is at stake.
Well, I guess it's what's at stake is the credibility of the sport because if things
just that?
Yeah, that's it. Because if things are being fixed at the lower levels, which is where the accusations are, I don't think anyone is suggesting that the final of Wimbledon or of Roland Garros or of any other major tournament is being fixed. But if things are being fixed at the lower levels, eventually those lower level players, you know, some of them become high level players, yeah, and they're still involved in the sport, and the sport isn't may know about it and isn't doing anything about it, then the credibility of the entire sport all of a sudden calls into question. And they are aware of that. I mean, the people who run tennis, I believe, are fully aware of that.
And the reason why, and Jim, I would like to get your seedy opinions here because you are a known gambler. The reason why tennis is such a desirable sport for this kind of activity is, one, because there's tons of gambling about this around the world. Is there not, Jim?
Matt's article said that online in the UK, tennis has surpassed horse racing. Online gambling.
Online gambling. And much, much more than what we're accustomed to here legally on the NFL and Vegas and so on. Secondly, you just got to get to one guy.
Exactly.
One athlete,
that's
right?
Really the key to it. And I mean, I think it's why boxing was so corrupt for a long time,
right,
was because you could always get one guy to take a fall. And I think, and from what I hear, tennis is even more susceptible to it than something like boxing right now because of the way the game is set up and because of the way people gamble now, throughout the competition. So people are betting on who's going to win this next set, who's going to win this next game.
Right.
And there are so many breaks in the action of tennis as people have time
to run to the window,
make a bet on something like that. And then at the same time, it also makes it more liable to be fixed because you can get a guy and to say, okay, just throw this set and then you can win the rest of the match. Or you can get both guys, if they're playing 2 out of 3, you can say, you win this set, you win this set, and then you guys can have the third set for yourselves and play it out then.
Which is like hits and giggles, and these exhibitions are like that, where they wink, wink, take turns winning sets.
Jim, you are, in addition to being a compulsive gambler, you are a big tennis fan, and you know, if you're not having access like these guys, maybe you do, maybe you are fixing tennis matches. I don't know what you do on the weekends, Jim. Is tennis a hard sport to bet, in your estimation?
Well, I think there's, you know, as Matt said, I think, you know, picking the winner of the match, you don't get that great odds because usually there's a heavy favorite, especially in the highest level.
Right.
But I think if you're betting per set or per, you know, game, there's also these prop bets of who wins the first game of the match.
Right.
So you could fix that by just having Djokovic drop serve in the first game of a match.
And so what people are watching and what regulators are supposed to be watching is on any sort of unnatural movement of money on any sort of specific bet, right? I mean, that's what they're supposed to be looking out there for, Matt. Is that correct?
Yes, they're looking for... All of a sudden, there's a lot of money on the 18th player in the world losing the first set to the 250th ranked player.
Or winning. I think the Davidenko situation was Davidenko won the first set against the nobody, and then heavy money came in on the nobody to still win the match at great odds, and that was what raised the red flag, I believe.
And that these things can't necessarily be explained away. Now, the tricky part of it, of course, is that, you know, in absence of some sort of smoking gun, like a document or a sack of money, it's awfully hard to go about proving this. And tennis has had an awfully hard time, though these suspicions, as you said, Matt, have been sticking around for a long time. They haven't, you know, they took one guy away, right? They suspended, gave a lifetime suspension to one player. But this is not some sort of like roundup going on.
And the question is whether there's no roundup because they don't want to do a roundup or for the same reason that there haven't been any really, really good stories in any publication across the world about a good tennis player.
Or names being named.
Yeah, because the reporting isn't there and they haven't been able to get at it. It's probably a decently hard story.
But also that they don't feel they can make it stand up legally. I mean, I imagine that's part of it too.
Right, but I think if they had the reporting, either the investigators or some journalists, they would put it out there and they would say, I mean, I'm talking about reporting, not just saying that there are some weird patterns here. I'm talking about finding the guy who's trying to fix these matches and having documents and emails and text messages and bank statements and all the other things that go into actual real investigations. I mean, I'm not someone who runs down other reporters' stories publicly very often. I had a little bit of a problem with this story because it was sort of their algorithm and, you know, and them saying, see, these are weird patterns. You know, this is definitely happening. And they didn't have the kind of thing that you saw in the Lance Armstrong story, which was all these guys on his team saying, yeah, we doped, and here's how we kept the blood in the refrigerator.
Right. Well, in fairness, a smaller circle, I imagine. But also, but the reason why this seems to have life here, Matt, besides the fact that it's sort of like, you know, it's a sexy allegation, it's because tennis, as you wrote so eloquently, is very much in bed with the gambling establishment to the point of signing a 5-year, $70 million deal. This is the ITF, the International Tennis Federation, signing with a gambling outfit. And this is not for, as you say, the Grand Slams, the Australian Open, the French, the Wimbledon, U.S. Open. This is for the rinky-dinkiest Caddyshack-style tennis tournaments around the world full of players you've never heard of and never will hear of. It's because this
and
is
to get,
also...
And to get real-time data on those matches.
So if you can imagine... Like, when you go out, Jim, to the Pinewoods member guests, and all of a sudden people were supplying real data from your, you know, adventure on the 18 holes to gamblers who are ready to gamble. I mean, that's what the equivalent is here. I mean, these are the dinkiest things.
It's pretty astonishing. I mean, these are tournaments going on, you know, now in Turkey and Tunisia and Egypt and, you know, with players that you have never heard of and in all likelihood will never hear of.
And are incredibly enticing candidates to be
corrupted.
Sure, there's
no money involved. And the tennis, and so the ITF, the International Tennis Federation, which incidentally does not have a lot of opportunities to make money because it doesn't control a lot of the high-profile tournaments. It only controls the Davis Cup and these rinky-dink tournaments.
Right. And no one's buying the rights of the Poughkeepsie Challenger. You know, it's not some sort of lucrative television market.
And they know very well that the only reason this stuff has value is because there's a huge gambling market. And so they're taking a premium on that deal. And
it's like greyhound racing, Jim, sort of.
It is. Or, you know, hey, there's a lot of little tracks across the country where there's people making a bet on something.
And so they are, without question, abetting this industry that they say is, you know, a huge threat to them. And, you know, the ATP and the WTA, which is the men's tour and the women's tour, they also have their real-time data deals, and the tournaments they control are not all, you know, massive events. There's a lot of what would qualify as rinky-dink events on those tours, too.
But see, what I was wondering, and I was talking about Matt, I brought this up with Matt the other day, was, I mean, to me, it's similar to if one wanted to bet on D3 college football. How many people are actually betting money on this? And the you know, as a person who wants to fix these matches, you would have to pay an amount to fix the matches and then bet enough to get your money's worth. And that's the question of, you know, the bookmakers want, you know, it to be honest because they have an incentive to make money, right?
Yeah, it's a volume business, as it was explained to me. We're talking about something on the order of 93,000 matches every year that will take place under the auspices of the ITF. So you're not making a huge killing on every match, but if you're making a little bit on every match or every tournament, you make your margins.
Right. That's how you do it. That's how you do it, Jim. One thing that I've been seeing in these stories and I don't quite still understand is that I don't know if it's ATP or what governing agency has spent a lot of time seeking out courtside statisticians, people who are kind of sitting courtside, like, you know, Carl Bialik of the world, who are sitting there with their computers supplying information to subscribers of some. I mean, what exactly is this that we're talking about here?
it's the same data that they want to control and that they do control, and that their exclusive rights data rights holder now controls.
But how the hell can they control courtside data gathering?
Well, it's very difficult, especially because people can relay stuff via phone. But I think what the idea is that they'll be able to catch these people forensically and electronically, because their data is going, the official data, the way they've rigged it now, goes straight from the umpire's chair, whose tablets are wired into the official partner system, onto that official partner site. And anyone whose data is following 10 seconds later, 30 seconds later, I would say, who's doing this on TV, which is, you know, the way you could sort of do it from the NFL.
So it's the speed is what's the issue.
Yeah, the speed is the issue. Interesting. Speed is a real issue here, apparently. And you know, just like Michael Lewis wrote that whole book about the guy trying to, the guy building the pipeline from Chicago to New York to save half a second or a second and a half. It's the same idea. There's a margin in 30 seconds when it comes to the gambling world.
Yeah, absolutely. Like in tennis, where a break is a significant thing, if you have a guy who can tell a bettor that, you know, this guy has a break before the bookmaker knows that that guy broke serve, that's a significant event, right?
And presumably it also weeds out television as being the access point, right? Because television is always a few seconds behind.
Yeah, that's a big thing. And that's a big thing with the, you know, with the NFL, which has a deal actually for its real-time data with the same outfit that the ITF has its deal with. The NFL deal is worth about a third of what the ITF's deal is, which is kind of astonishing. There are some regulations in there about Sportradar not being able to supply NFL data to gambling outfits. I don't know how stringently they are policing that and making sure that there isn't some sort of sister company to Sportradar who's also getting the same data and supplying it, but you know, they have someone in the stadium and no one else is supposed to have someone in the stadium.
Matt, I just want to tell you something personally, that you and I played a match last year.
We did in
Austin, Texas.
It was great. And just as we were about to start playing, you looked up and you said, "It's like Federer and Nadal at the Open. This has never happened," because it was our lone match we had ever played.
But you know where this is going, Matt. Jim paid me $10,000 to throw that match to you.
Oh. Wow.
Yeah. I was following via sport data.
The whole credibility of my career has now been thrown into question.
Yeah. So, you know, now it can be told. Matt, what's next on this story? What's the next, you know, we have the Australian Open underway.
Yes, and I think what's next is you will continue to have these sort of surreal moments, like what happened in the Djokovic press conference. I'm going to mess up the time difference now. I think it was yesterday, but Australia is like 38 hours ahead of Eastern time zone, so I have no idea whether it was yesterday, today, tomorrow. Anyway, where a journalist was asking him about some match in 2007 where he was playing against, I think, an Italian player who wasn't very good, and he was winning, and he ended up losing. And there were two great moments
in
it.
One,
where Djokovic is basically saying, like, yeah, this is what's going to happen. Everyone's going to keep throwing matches in our faces where we lost, where we weren't supposed to lose. And, like, what can I say other than I didn't take money on that match? Like, you know, maybe it looks weird that I lost. I'm sorry I lost. But the other thing that I thought was cool, and I've always thought this was incredibly cool about both tennis players and golfers, is his memory. Like, out of the blue, the reporter asks him about a match in 2007. Yeah. He's like, yeah, the Sarlo match. I lost the first set. All right. And he basically could recite the match by heart, which is if you go up to a golfer and you ask him about, like, a tournament and what club he used on the fifth hole, like, they have that in their mind. And every tennis player has this as well. It's amazing. So those are the combination of the memory and the reporters asking about obscure matches is going to be a very funny interchange moving
It's going to happen the entire year, right? Every time a player loses a small tournament.
It'll be like the doping in cycling. You know, every time anybody has some sort of exceptional performance, they have to defend it. A little different because they're defending a win as opposed to what these tennis players
are. And we're not going to have...
defending strange losses. I want to wrap...
I was going to say, we're not going to have the moment, you know, there's a famous U.S. Open moment where Goran Ivanišević loses, like, rather feebly, and he said he was affected by the smell of the hamburgers coming from the stations. And then, you know, no one said, hey, you might have been tanking that or fixed, you know, the match fixing was involved.
Right. Well, and those hamburgers were stinky.
And I will basically believe that anything happens in sport. At this point, after the year that I've had in terms of from a coverage standpoint, because I have gone from these brazen $120 million bribery deals in FIFA to the Russians and the head of the International Track and Field Federation extorting money from runners to cover up their doping tests to now dealing, you know, with these tennis bribery things. So as far as I'm concerned, like... sure, I'm sure it happens. Everything happens, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
you're
better off just believing everything at this point.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point. Matt Futterman, we should also mention, author of a soon-to-be-coming-out book in April, Players! Players! The story of sports, money, and the visionaries who fought to create a revolution. It has no application to today's games, but sounds like it's interesting. Very, very positive reviews from Publishers Weekly, Kirkus! Starred reviews, Jim.
Available for pre-order.
You can pre-order it on many outlets because I was told when I was writing my book I couldn't specify one over the other. So a neutral endorsement of buying Matt's book from any retailer. I want an AFC, NFC prediction from each of you. Who's going to play in the Super Bowl? Let's start with you, Futterman. You're the guest.
The Panthers and the Patriots.
Okay, Jimbo?
I'm going Cardinals-Patriots.
It's so boring. Panthers-Patriots, you know, reprise
it's
of the...
boring. I mean, there's only like four possibilities.
It's funny. There's no momentum. In Denver, you know, you'd think Peyton Manning would be this incredible sentimental story, but people are kind of like, eh.
Well, he doesn't look like a very good quarterback at this point.
No,
so that's the problem. They're probably hoping for snow or something.
Yeah. Hey, Jim, have you ever smoked synthetic marijuana?
I have not.
Matt?
Unfortunately, no.
Yeah. I think one of us needs to do that. If the Patriots get to the Super Bowl, one of us needs to do that. It's sort of a man on the street kind of story.
Although,
it's legal. It's legal. It's not against the law.
Well, and in Colorado, of course, everything's legal.
This is true,
point,
and the Patriots are in Denver. This has been the free-for-all. This is our longest podcast ever. If you fell asleep halfway through it, which I doubt because Brett Stevens was so awesome, but if you have some thoughts about today's pod, shoot us a note at WSJ Sports. Follow us on the Twitter bird, and also locate us, subscribe to us on the Apple iTunes. Let us know what you think of this podcast. This is Jason Gay, and this is the Free For All.